Welcome to another episode of TV Babble, where if you like to hear people theorize, fangirl, and yes, babble about TV, you've come to the right place. I'm Jim Halterman, West Coast Bureau Chief of TV Guide Magazine, and the teams from TV Guide Magazine and TVInsider.com are here to talk all things TV. This week, our senior writer Damien Holbrook leads a roundtable about sci-fi characters we love and those we hate, along with senior critic Matt Rausch and assistant editor Emily Aslanian. Between The Walking Dead, Game of Thrones, Westworld, the trio had a lot to say, so make sure to listen to the whole thing. And then after that, Damien's latest cheers and jeers about American Horror Story's new season and whether we need a Designing Women reboot. But first, Maggie Grace has a terrific episode of Fear the Walking Dead coming on September 2nd on the AMC series, so I grabbed some time with her to talk Althea, her relationship with Jenna Elfman's character June, and what else we can expect this season on The Walking Dead spinoff. Let's start babbling. I want to know, just first of all, how are you, you know, feeling playing her? Because now you've been playing her for a little bit as opposed to just jumping in. But how is your relationship with Al, I should say, as far as playing her?
We explore a much more vulnerable side of Althea in the second half of four. And there's situations and challenges that push her closer than I think she'd normally be comfortable to this newly cobbled together little tribe.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's easy to have this fearlessness about her, this belief that she's lost everything and has nothing more to lose until she has to really stare death in the face. And it's certainly a character that's been molded by this world both before and after the fall,
yeah,
as it were, into somebody who's very capable, but, you know, she's not brittle either. This is still a woman who could cry out of awe, who can still see beauty. Like, she's got, you know, certainly a vulnerable side. It's just harder to get to. Like, you know, she's really gone with what's worked for her,
yeah,
since society fell. And usually that's the shortest route from A to B. Like, she's very practical. She doesn't spend a lot of time in her head. She spent most of her time out of her head, not in it. You know, it's just interesting to play with how she would deal with being armorless. Like, her... Sorry, I'm rambling.
No, this is good. This is perfect. This is good stuff. No, keep going.
Yeah. I mean, this is a woman who, like, her closest and most stable relationship in the past, you know, at least recently, has been with a SWAT van, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah.
But she's starting to, I think in by 4:12, you start to see she's risking caring for this group. Like, they need her and she needs them. And that's not a cozy, comfortable feeling for her, given,
yeah,
where she's coming from.
Well, and the fact that, you know, we first met her, you know, she's looking at everything through a camera and she's got this kind of journalistic look at everything. At this point, for this episode in particular, is she having a hard time, like, holding on to that? Because, you know, one, the camera battery may be dying soon and those kinds of things. But is it making her kind of look at things differently now that she doesn't have that viewfinder, so to speak?
Yeah, I think the easiest way to deal with, you know, a lot of elements that might kill you, or certainly doing their level best to kill you, is to stay focused on the viewfinder.
Yeah.
And so she's certainly got a lot of defense mechanisms and protections that have worked for her. And a lot of those get stripped away, you know, the further we head into the end of the season.
Yeah.
She's still got more to lose, actually, even after 4:12, believe it or not.
Of course, of course.
I think you know, there's definitely a sort of haunting darkness she carries, and mm-hmm, this really hardcore commitment to document others' lives. Like, a commitment until the very end of the line.
Yeah.
That we'll understand more of as we go on. Like, if she can solve the puzzles of other people, maybe she can solve her own.
That's good, yeah.
And yeah, I'm excited to dig into who she really is and how she survived. Like, as much as we love them,
sure,
a SWAT van and push daggers don't double as as personhood. So, you know, it's exciting to delve a little deeper.
Well, in this
forward.
Yeah, in this episode, it's almost like what's worse, getting just sick with, you know, whatever she has, whether it's the flu or something, or these zombies, because when you have no medicine, she could just as easily die from being sick. I mean, it's,
yeah, I think that's the cool thing that, you know, the series has done is, you know, more leaning on the metaphor of social decay. And of course the big bad is never the zombies, it's always us, like our own nature, and then of course just the practical side of how helpless most of us would be without kind of the social contract. Like, so few of us can do any one process from beginning to end, and you know, whether it be food production or medicine, or like, we're all so vulnerable.
Yeah,
fragile fleshy bags of water. That's great for prayer right there.
What, of course, it is, I mean, it's not fun, but you see how attached she is to the SWAT van for a lot of reasons. Can you just kind of define what the SWAT van kind of represents for her, just so I have it in your words?
Oh gosh.
If you can. I mean, it's probably a tough one to come up
yeah,
with.
Yeah, I mean, it's the one constant she's had. It's also very tied to, there's only so much I'm allowed to say. It's also very tied to her past.
Yeah.
And the, you know, who she's lost. It's home. I mean, it's her one safe haven in a very unsafe world. And the one thing she can count on, and she'll really risk anything to stay connected to it.
Okay.
I mean, I think her experience has taught her, you know, that's the one thing she really has going for her out there. I'm not sure where she gets the diesel, but
she knows a guy.
You know, movie magic. Yeah, she's
exactly.
Got a guy.
How would you describe for this episode how she feels about June? Because they aren't necessarily besties at this point, but how would you describe that relationship? Yeah. They've been thrust together.
Someone at some point asked me, like, you know, why Al was antagonistic. And I was like, what? Really? I never thought of her that way. I just think, you know, given the circumstances, look at the world she lives in. Like, trust is earned.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't just, you know, fall out your front door every morning and, you know, make new besties. It's not all strawberries and sunshine and rainbows. Like, you know, you really let people show you who they are. And so far, what she's seen from Laura, Naomi, June has not been, you know, exactly straight up. So it's like, is everybody in their best suits or is this fucking everybody?
Right.
You know, like, what's your actual name? What do you want? Who are you? You know, I don't think she holds her responsible in the way that Alicia does for what went down at the stadium.
Yeah.
But she's not sure what her history is with the Vultures, what she's after. You know, certainly there seems to be a really beautiful bond between June and John.
Yeah.
Dory. But, you know, in terms of, like, how Al relates to her, that's still to be seen, to be earned.
Yeah. When somebody has multiple...
Like, there seems to be, like, something, you know, unresolved there.
Yeah.
Like, she has to check her out. You know, it's an almost animal thing. Like, you really have to make sure that person's safe.
Well, and when someone has, like, three different names they keep bouncing between, it's like, wait, who are you? Because you keep changing your name.
Yeah. She's a reasonable person. I mean, she's not you know, aggressively unkind at any point, but she's sort of like, let's June, you know, demonstrate who she is.
Okay.
First.
I like it. That's good. What you I won't spoil exactly what happens, but you do get to fight one of the zombies in this episode, which as a viewer I always enjoy watching. But is that a fun day as an actor when you're actually, you know, one of those things is right in your face? I know there's all makeup in that, but what's a day like that like when that's a part of it?
Just imagine how much mud wrestling there was for like 10 seconds of screen time. It's like 12 hours of
Oh my God.
Hardcore mud wrestling. honestly. You know, our stunt people are fantastic and so committed and super professional. So yeah, we had that day down, and a lot of it we had to do on a platform to get the camera angles. Greg Nicotero is a genius.
Yeah.
But in terms of, you know, a lot of the violence and its effects, a lot of it happens in CG. And then what we do on set is like this glorious little athletic dance number that we've all rehearsed together, you know, especially the stuff that's up on its feet.
Yeah. My God.
And, you know, there's no, you know, there's very light contact. And then they add in all this stuff later that's super gnarly. But on this particular day, a lot was dressed in real effects. And I was just so profoundly disturbed.
It makes sense. I can see why.
Yeah. But then my character's very, I've seen worse.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about Al's look, because do you like her look? Do you like her hair? Because I guess you don't have to do a lot with your hair, but it's... Yeah, it's a cool haircut.
Was actually mine.
Oh,
and then
okay.
They asked me to go dark, probably so I wouldn't look like Tank Girl.
I know that reference. So, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. but yeah, I chopped all my hair off out of my own sense of freedom. And they were like, oh, cool. Before this role.
Okay.
Just for my own.
That's
edification.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah, super fun.
Yeah, okay. That's cool. What,
it's easy.
What's, you know,
pop out of the shower and you're done.
Yeah, I love it. Coleman directed this episode, so I'm always curious what it's like when you have one of your fellow actors directing, if it's what the experience is different, if there's more of a trust
sure.
there.
Well,
tell me about that.
Yeah, everyone sort of assumes that, but he's, it's not just like having one of your fellow actors directing. Like, Coleman has this huge body of work as a playwright,
yeah,
and director in his own right. So I get why some people would be like, oh, sometimes actors have that in their contract and it's, you know, a fun week or whatever. But no, this was, he's just immensely prepared and I think should be directing so much more, not only on this series but others. Like, he
yeah.
was just an absolute joy, and especially for this episode where, you know, Jenna and I had so much to dig into. I couldn't have been, you know, happier. I just felt so lucky that it happened to be Coleman's episode. You know, there's such a shorthand. He's so communicative.
Yeah.
He's an emotional ninja, and he knows what he wants, and he's really prepared and knew the shots, and the crew loved him. And you know, it was so much more than an actor thinking they might like to direct. I mean, he was just infinitely prepared, and I hope he directs a lot of episodes next season. That's
yeah,
great.
I love talking to him. He's so cool.
I think it was pretty awesome to see an episode that every scene broke the Bechdel test. Like, that never happens.
That's right.
Yeah, and the episode before, I think, with Alicia.
That's right. Yeah, I saw that one,
Alexa
too.
As well.
Good stuff.
Yeah, I think my sort of takeaway from this was, it just, you know, I think it's really, like, zeitgeisty to talk about badass women and strong female characters, and it was nice not to oversimplify what strong means.
Yeah.
Like, with her in the second half of 4... you know, this emotional detachment and kind of tough qualities are marched around as this prize of finally having strong female characters. But what really made me happy is to have a character beyond that, a woman that's well-written and believable. Like, I think how we've traditionally done for men, and for the worse, I think, putting a woman in a box marked strong, mm-hmm, kind of limits the spectrum of emotions they're allowed to experience. And obviously, in storytelling, we never want to limit or deny the humanity of the person in question. So,
yeah,
what's really revelatory to me is to explore weakness in the same character. To, you know, have a character that's allowed a full spectrum of emotion and capability and flaws. Thank God, like, mm-hmm. that's not defined by her relationship to the men around her, like her accomplishments are her own. What she brings to the team has nothing to do with her gender. Like, that to me was such a win and so revelatory, and I'm really grateful for the opportunity.
Hi, I'm Damian Holbrook, and today we're going to be talking about the sci-fi horror characters we absolutely adore and the ones we could do without. These can be characters and shows that are currently on TV or ones that have long since disappeared, but they're all going to have something in common. They're going to have characters we loved and hated. I am sitting here with Emily Aslanian, TV Guide Magazine's assistant editor, and Matt Rausch, senior critic at TV Guide Magazine. How are you guys?
Oh, we're great.
Good.
Great.
So sci-fi genre stuff, horror, TV. I know Matt and I are huge horror fans, and I just found out that Emily is also a massive horror fan.
I've been hiding it.
Okay. Never. Don't hide it. That's awesome.
No, I know. I'm obsessed.
The problem is horror on TV can be very difficult.
Yes.
Like, because sometimes it can't be scary because of network standards, or they get too thinky. So I want to hear...
How do you sustain them? Because, I mean, horror is meant to be sort of this contained story, and like something like Castle Rock is such a slow burn. It's like, when is it really ever going to get truly scary? And then it has its moments, but it's not quite there yet. But,
whereas,
you know,
The Exorcist, they did a pretty solid job on a weekly basis of scaring us.
Loved it.
Yeah.
Loved it.
I have high hopes, as I know you do, Emily, for The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina.
Yes, very excited for that.
And it seems like they're going to stick very closely to the comic books, which are demented and sick, so I'm and the fact that it's on Netflix, they can actually do stuff.
Right.
Is it like an extension of Riverdale, the Riverdale character, or they're only going
so
kind of far
beyond? It's
going
to be its own thing. Mm-hmm. It's in the same universe, but they will not have any crossovers or connections because this is truly existing in the world of the occult.
Cool.
Yeah. All right, so let's hear about, so let's start with the negative, so we can always end on a positive note, because we at TV Guide love TV. Mm-hmm. So which characters can you just go without?
Well, mine's a very, very significant character, and I know that he was big in the comic books, but I have watched The Walking Dead the entire time without having dipped into the comics, because I feel like I should have this kind of pure experience with the show. I thought it was amazing from the start. Even in some of its slower seasons, I was always there. That whole existential tone of living through this apocalypse and there's the hopelessness of it all. But then along came Negan, a character who was so telegraphed, and people were talking about it for years before he showed up because he was so big in the comics. When he finally showed up, played by one of my favorite actors, Jeffrey Dean Morgan, who I liked in everything from Supernatural onward.
Yeah.
But here, I think it's the worst role he's ever had, the worst he's ever done in a role. I find that the strutting and the preening that he does, I find it more tiresome than scary.
He's so overwritten.
And it's just been this whole thing where it's played out to where it becomes this like shoot 'em up between the bad guys and the good guys. And yeah, there's always a sense that horror can also play in that sort of Western genre, being sort of mythic and timeless. But I think that Negan has just worn out his welcome, and the fact that he survived this last onslaught, and no matter what, how he kind of plays into this new world they're creating in this strange meshing of communities, he's always going to be the odd man out for me. Number two on that list, though, is Eugene, the guy with the mullet. Is like the most annoying character on that show, and the fact that he's been able to survive all these different twists and turns. And, you know, we've lost so many characters we have a true connection to. I can't imagine anybody having a true connection to this guy. He's the guy that you would leave on the side of the road, and I wish they had.
Damn. All right,
that's
Emily,
cold.
That is
cold.
Yes. What about you?
So mine is a pretty popular one as well. It is Joffrey from Game of Thrones. I read all the books, and I was just as annoyed by his character in the books as I was in the TV show. I get that he's supposed to be an annoying character. Mm-hmm. By nature, he is annoying, but I just was so ready for him to die. When he finally did kick the bucket, I was pretty excited, as were a lot of fans, I think.
Oh, yeah. But I feel like he's very different in that we were supposed to love Negan.
Right.
Yeah.
But Joffrey, from the get-go, you're like, I think we're supposed to hate him.
Totally.
Yeah, so his death became
totally
like...
And I totally did.
Right.
But it was like, to a point where I was like, please just end this. Like, mm-hmm. I want to go on to the next big villain. And like, when Ramsay Bolton showed up,
so
he
good.
Is pure evil.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Oh, so like serial killer evil.
Amazing. Yeah. I loved that character. And I feel like Joffrey was just like a precursor that we didn't need.
But I think the difference there is that he played it well. I think the playing of Negan is it doesn't work for me as a dramatic character. Mm. Whereas Joffrey worked. And also the fact that he was a boy villain kind of made it interesting in the sense that he was this young kid. And Cersei still adored him, even though he was responsible for Ned's beheading and everything else that happened. And he was pure awful.
Just the worst.
And I don't think they played it out too far either. Of course, at that point, they were still hewing to the books pretty closely. So he dies in the third book, and that happened in the third or fourth season.
That's my thing. Like, I was going to go with somebody who overstayed their welcome, and I don't know how long they lasted in the books, but Carl on The Walking Dead, like, honestly, by episode two, I'm like, please let him die. Please let him be the next one. And the kid lingered like a cold, like, forever. And then they finally killed him off, and honestly, it got to a point he lasted so long that nobody cared that they killed him off. He had actually run out of being hateable as a character, and he wasn't like a bad kid. It just was so annoying. So my pick for the characters that just need to go, this is going to be horrible, the entire Robinson family on the Lost in Space reboot. Every one of them is useless. First of all, how they ever got picked to be like the pilots of like an exploratory ship, they are useless. They couldn't even get off of a mountaintop. I was so done with that group. And then I love Parker Posey. I don't know what they were thinking of doing with this character. I'm hoping that there are some changes behind the scenes for season two, because that entire lot of them should have perished and just like reboot.
Yeah, it's like they didn't even know each other, let alone being a family.
Honestly, I mean, so they were so miserable and unpleasant and just like, and they, again, they never got lost in space, but they were all so clearly not adept at what they were supposed to be experts at and just unwelcome company on my TV.
I think of the scene where Molly Parker playing June Robinson, right? Where she is sitting there executing that crazy space mission where they're trying to lose, and she's alone in the room. So she's alone in the room. Nobody else is like there to help her. So that allows Dr. Smith to come in and knock her out, like happening in like a bad 60s TV show, which maybe Lost in Space kind of was, but it was my 60s TV show. The reboot was horrible.
And that stuff doesn't fly now, nor did this show. No. So let's talk about the good ones. Let's talk about the characters that just make our shows, because there are some, like, and some of them are easy because they're the leads and everything, but do you guys have picks that are like second or third on the call list?
Well, mine was second or third on the call list, who's now become sort of a lead, because on Fear the Walking Dead has gone through an evolution in this new season that has made it actually superior to the mothership, whereas it was certainly not that way in the first couple of seasons, where I was just so aggravated and annoyed and it was slow and I didn't get what
so
it was
slow.
Doing. But this season they brought in new characters, almost all of them are really terrific. Garrett Dillahunt, Jenna Elfman at the top of her game, Maggie Grace, they're all doing terrific work on the show as new characters. But by killing off all of Alicia's family, which honestly, Nick in particular was just awful, but the mom making terrible decisions.
Was Nick the brother?
Nick was
the worst.
Yeah. And so the mom, who, you know, Kim Dickens, terrific actress in so many shows, but she had this habit of bringing her family into these situations, creating all this havoc. Everybody else dies and her entire nuclear family walks away intact. Mm-hmm. But in this last season, they killed Nick. Quite shockingly, she sacrifices herself. She had a hero's finale, Madison did, so that's fine. But Alicia has always been, to me, the most intriguing of the characters, a girl who's had to become a warrior in her own way. And now this season, she's kind of like carrying the action. So I think she's essential to the future of this show. And Fear the Walking Dead has actually become a much more watchable show than it ever was before by shedding its characters. Somebody once suggested to me that the way to keep this show going was to have made it an anthology, so each season would have followed a different packet of characters through the early part of the apocalypse. Because you have to believe the characters are expendable on this show, on all of the Walking Dead shows. But at the moment, for me, Alicia is inexpendable.
All right. What about you?
Mine is also kind of the same situation. They weren't necessarily like the top of the cast list, and then they kind of moved their way up there, especially with season two. Talking about Bernard in Westworld, I'm obsessed with him character-wise. Jeffrey Wright is incredible portraying him. I don't even like know what's going on half the time, and I love everything that he's doing, all of his decisions. Seeing him come at the host, realizing that the host's like kind of a thing from a completely different angle. I know, I can't even explain
it. It's hard.
It's so hard. It's just seeing him come at it from a different angle than like Dolores or Maeve or some of the other hosts that we see is just so interesting, and I love that juxtaposition. And his character kind of just carries us through the story in season two. So I'm kind of really into it.
He's sort of the most human of the hosts in many ways.
He was the longest human, right?
Right, yeah. And he doesn't, you know, because that first season was about discovery that he was a host. So the first season was all about discovery. The second season, again, he's damaged. So you're never really quite sure what's going on with him. And
so he
goes through the most evolution of any of those hosts. So he is the most fascinating character.
Well, and that's why my pick is also like the character who's gone through probably the biggest evolution is on The 100. former home of Alicia from Fear the Walking Dead, which is Richard Harmon's Murphy. A character who was actually supposed to be killed off, like, in the first three episodes. He's been hanged. I think he's been shot. He's been left for dead a couple times. Like, this character is impervious to death. But Richard Harmon has turned this guy. He was always a bad kid. He was a juvenile delinquent. But he has, over the course of five seasons, emerged as the most reluctant hero since, like, Han Solo. This character, like, I love watching him aggressively fight his worst instincts to become a heroic character. He has been so fun to watch. Obviously, you know, Eliza Taylor and Bob Morley's characters, Clark and Bellamy, are, you know, leading the charge. But Murphy has always been there to kind of be that counterbalance to the heroics, but still heroic in himself. And I've really enjoyed his character, his evolution. His portrayal has been great because you still don't trust him to come through, and he always does, but it's just been a delight to watch it.
And he's such a whipping boy. He can beat up all the time. Yeah. And so the fact that he keeps up getting back up.
And
he's not ever as bad as he thinks he is, but everybody thinks he's the worst, but he's the best. Yeah. I feel like at
the end of it, he's going to be the one who's still standing. Yeah.
He'll be the one left.
Well, that has been a very spirited conversation, and I cannot wait to hear what you guys think of that. So you can leave your comments or tweet us directly at TV Babble P, and we will hopefully try to engage you back and either combat your opinions or agree with them, because that's what we do. I want to thank Emily Aslanian and Matt Roush for joining us today, and we will talk to you guys later. Hey everyone, it's Damien again, and I'm sitting here thinking about my cheers and jeers right now. I am super excited because Ryan Murphy tweeted out a reunion photo of the American Horror Story Apocalypse cast, and it's got Sarah Paulson, Lily Rabe, Emma Roberts, Frances Conroy, Gabourey Sidibe, and Stevie Nicks, and Thaisa Farmiga. So that's almost all the characters that I think survived Coven, and I think that I have to cheer this. I'm super excited about where this show is going after so many seasons of being crazy to actually start connecting the dots between seasons. Very, very excited about that. Also, very, very excited about American Ninja Warrior. Once again, this show, it comes back every summer. It's super fun. But between Akbar and Matt, the two announcers, the show is, remember that feeling that we used to get when Ty Pennington would scream, "Move that bus," and Extreme Makeover Home Edition would, like, give us what the kids call all the feels, which is also a terrible saying. But that's what American Ninja Warrior has become. It is a feel-good TV show, and I have to cheer it for really celebrating different kinds of athletes, people who've overcome stuff, but not everybody has an Olympic-type tragedy behind them. But they're really just dedicated, and their families are cheering for them, and the crowd is cheering for them, and it's just really, really fun to see some positivity on TV. Now, for the jeering section, I cannot tell you how disturbed I am by the idea of a Designing Women reboot. This is not where we need to be headed. I understand that, yes, the Will and Grace reboot did great, and the Magnum PI reboot looks like it could be fun, and the revival of Murphy Brown gets the whole cast back together. But listen, Hollywood, stop. Even if you want to just go steal the idea and rename it, we don't need the Sugar Bakers being played by other people. It is a classic show for a reason. It is a classic. It does not need to be improved upon or tweaked by somebody who might think that this is a great way to get money or rating. Just go create a new show with four strong female characters, maybe a trans character, maybe a drag queen. I don't care, but don't call it Designing Women. Give them something else to do. And also, by the way, Grace Adler is the only designer we need on fictional TV right now. Sorry. Another jeer that I don't know if this is a jeer so much as a what are people thinking, but Colton Underwood on Bachelor in Paradise, for the longest time on The Bachelorette, the virginal football player who is kind of a hunk, he was like the sweetheart. We all loved him. Now that he's on Bachelor in Paradise, everybody's turning against him and saying that he has ulterior motives for going on and getting together with Tia. I don't buy it. I feel like this is one of those things where the reality shows like to flip the script on characters and paint them as the bad guy. I've met the guy. There's no way he's the villain. the fact that they're trying to make Jordan the air quote model into a good guy is not okay either. But this whole Colton is a bad guy, let's all pile up on him, it's not okay. This is, we need to maintain some purity in our crappy reality shows. And when you pile on the sweethearted hunky virgin, no. No bueno. I will not allow. So those are my cheers and jeers for right now. I'm sure there's more that I'm sitting on, and I'll come back to you with more of them on our next podcast. And what you have to say matters. So tweet us at TV Babble P, and we will play some back and forth, hopefully. Talk to you guys later.
Thanks for joining us on this very sci-fi-centric episode of TV Babble. We'll be back in 2 weeks with some of our pre-Emmy coverage and more TV to babble about. Thank you to our producer, Lori Perna, and the staffs of TV Guide Magazine and TVInsider.com. Remember to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss a single episode, and follow us on social media and let us know how we're doing and what you think of the podcast. Until next time, keep babbling.